change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program of economic analysis that looks at our jobs, our incomes, our debts, and our futures in terms of the goods and services we produce and we take in as income. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, been a professor of economics all my adult life, and now I work on writing things and on doing these kinds of programs and speaking around the country to give a different analysis, a different take on what's happening to the economic aspects of our lives, and I'll have more to tell you about that later in the program. Let's jump right into the first part of each week's program, shorter economic updates about items in the news, items that I think you might be interested in. The first one that I want to talk about might be called, and it's appropriate for the season, capitalism's crazy Christmas. Things are happening now that reveal a system in trouble literally every day. And sometimes the events group together in a way that allows me to show you how the system is really not working for us anymore. So let's do the one that is in the news a lot recently. Part of this is the story of the sudden drop in the price of oil that has affected everybody. Another part of the same story is the fracking issue that is roiling America as state by state politicians and citizens struggle with the ecological damage of this new way of forcing petroleum out of the earth. And still another dimension are the problems in places like Norway and Russia and Venezuela and other oil-producing companies and countries as they cope with the collapse of oil prices. So let's see how it all hangs together. It starts with the energy crisis. As everyone who's reasonable knows, we are burning fossil fuels, above all oil, in a way that damages the environment, threatens our health, produces global warming, climate catastrophes, floods, droughts, you name it. And everybody who's reasonable knows that what we really need to learn how to do is to consume less of it, to give ourselves less of the damage from burning fossil fuels by burning less of them. This is not rocket science. So a rational society would be working really hard on producing alternative kinds of energy, wind, solar, and so on, but above all, cutting consumption. And there are lots of ways of doing that. But in our society, which is governed by the rules and drives of capitalism, profit-driving enterprises above all else, we're not cutting on our consumption in a significant way. Instead, we're focusing on finding new and different sources of petroleum. And we've done that, particularly in the United States with shale oil and so on, from North Dakota at the top to Texas, the middle part of the United States. There's a boom been going on for some years in bringing new sources of petroleum to the surface. So it's ecological disaster, and even suicide isn't too strong a word for what we're doing. And it's economically irrational because it isn't the solution we know we need, which is less consumption. Instead, it's more production. Now, step two. Besides the bad thing for the environment, we're not planning this in any way. In other words, the explosion of oil found through fracking from these new sources, particularly in the United States, is being dumped on the world market in a relatively short amount of time. That means the supply of oil is going up dramatically. Okay, stay with me now. At the same time, the capitalist system has produced a breakdown ever since 2008, and that breakdown is still very severe in Japan, very severe in Europe, and very much still with us here in the United States. And when you have depressed economies because of a capitalist crisis, the demand for oil is reduced. Okay, we're producing more than ever through fracking and the damage it does, and we're demanding less. And the result is, surprise, surprise, a collapse in the price of oil. Okay, now let's take it the next step. What are the consequences of that? Well, there's good news and bad news, which is true of the consequences of everything. Here's the good news, because that's what the media seems to want to focus on. We all spend less to fuel our automobiles, to heat our homes. Whether we're individuals or businesses, we are saving money on the energy we all require. That's useful. That improves the economic situation of all of the consumers of oil. But that's only part of the story. The other part is, what's happening to the producers and sellers of oil? Well, they are in deep trouble. Norway, Russia, Venezuela, Nigeria, Iran, Iraq, these countries that rely to a large extent on selling oil are suddenly seeing their economies disintegrate. Over this last week, there's been a major crisis in Russia. There's been a major change in economic policies in Norway, in Nigeria, in Venezuela. We don't even know what the effects on the already destroyed country of Iraq will be now that they can't generate the only income they had for a while, which was from their oil. The ramifications of this are staggering. Because think about it. When oil prices are high, we all pay a lot extra, which funnels its way into the hands of a tiny number of very rich folks. Leaders of Saudi Arabia, leaders of big oil companies, leaders in Russia, and so forth. A lot of us pay, and a few gather the money. They put that money in the banks. That's wonderful for the banks, who have huge blocks of money that they can now use in a variety of ways, answering only to a few authorities. When you take all that money away, which is what falling oil prices do, you're dispersing the money. Now let's follow it. Russia, Norway, big oil companies, they're going to have to, and they're already doing it, cut back on the projects that they had expected to finance with all of the money from selling oil, which they're not getting anymore because the oil prices are down. They're canceling all kinds of investment programs. They're canceling all kinds of purchases that they had made because they can't pay for them. Russia is a major buyer of products from Europe. The European economy, already weak, will be weakened more because of the loss of those orders. You have to weigh that against whatever gains Europeans get by having cheaper oil. No one knows how that's going to all work out, and it's going to vary from country to country, from situation to situation. That's why this whole thing is chaotic. This is not a rational way to handle neither the ecological dimensions of oil nor the financial consequences of a drop in the oil price. Why let it happen so quickly? That's an economy that's not working well, is it? So whether you look at the ecological or the financial dimensions, this is a disaster. And it's upon us, shaping us, shaping world politics, as well as world economics, because a system is spinning out of control and isn't working very well. And the irony here is, it isn't working in a stable way, it isn't working in a rational way, it isn't working the way we want, and that's true for all of us, even those who sit at the top of the pyramid. They at least get a lot of money out of all of this, but even they are going to suffer the ecological and other consequences of a system that we can do better than, and nothing illustrates it more than capitalism's crazy Christmas time in the year 2014. Let me turn to another shorter update. This one will be briefer. With some sadness, the governor of Vermont this last week stopped a four-year process in the state of Vermont that had been intended and aimed at giving Vermont a single-payer health insurance program quite like the one that exists in Canada, and far more comprehensive than anything that exists in the other 49 states of the United States. Vermont was a leader. And Governor Shumlin stopped that this last week. That's sad. Sad for the people of Vermont. Sad for the rest of the United States, which might have had, sooner than otherwise, a working model of a single-payer system in one of the 50 states that would have certainly inspired many folks in other states to do the same. And I wanted to find out and report to you why this happened. Why did the governor stop it? Did he stop it because somehow providing universal health care isn't a good idea anymore? On the contrary, he made it crystal clear he believes in it as much or more than ever before. Well, then what was the reason? If it wasn't the revelation, if it wasn't the Republican and right-wing critics of the very idea having persuaded him, nothing of the sort. The answer was money. And so I wanted to talk again about yet another dimension of capitalism's dysfunction. Here's where the items that Mr. or Governor Shumlin pointed to explain his decision. First, there are lingering effects of the recession, he said. And he pointed specifically to projections that he had gotten from his advisors that there would be a downdraft of revenue to the government of Vermont over the next year in the neighborhood of $75 million. In other words, capitalism's failure to have recovered, much to the chagrin of those who think we are in one, the failure of our economy to recover, here we are 6-7 years since this crisis hit, is one of the reasons why Vermont cannot give its people the single-payer health insurance system it had intended. What else affected him? The new medical care bill, Obamacare, Affordable Care Act. This involves a loss, it turns out, to the state of Vermont of $150 million less in federal help and an additional $150 million less in Medicaid and particularly Medicaid assistance. In other words, the so-called medical reforms that have been decimated as they go through Congress, plus a dysfunctional capitalist economy in the United States, those are the reasons. The hard economic reasons why Vermont had to postpone, according to the governor, the single-payer health initiative they had undertaken. Next item, moving quite along. This last week saw a political international bombshell. The United States decided to end the embargo of Cuba and to reestablish normal and full diplomatic relations with that island country 90 miles away. And I wanted not to talk about the politics. You will have many other opportunities to read and think and about all that. I want to do the economics, because that's what we do on this program. So, 55 years of the United States trying to change politics in Cuba by imposing economic costs. It began really in 1960, a year after Fidel Castro overthrows the dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista in Cuba. In 1960, that a year after Castro comes to power with his revolutionaries, the United States imposes an embargo. The important thing to understand there is that the single most important product of the Cuban economy at that time was sugar. Sugar grows better in Cuba than it does anywhere else on the face of this planet. This small island of 7-8 million people is more efficient and produces better cane sugar than anywhere on Earth, and they sold it to the colossus to their north, the United States, which has a sweet tooth, and at that time particularly imported virtually all the sugar Cuba could produce. When the United States said it would not buy any more sugar, when the United States government intervened in the free trade it celebrates elsewhere, to shut off free trade, to close the United States, to forbid American companies to buy and import Cuban sugar, they, of course, made the Cuban economy face imminent collapse, which would happen in any society that was as dependent on one crop and then saw the market for that crop cut off from one day to the next. What the Cubans did thereafter is, of course, understandable economically. They looked for someplace else to sell their sugar because their lives literally depended on it. The Soviet Union at the time stepped in and bought a huge amount, other countries in Europe and elsewhere also. But this turning to the Soviet Union then led in 1961 to the United States to support, arm, equip, and transport an invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and this was defeated by the Castro military and the Castro-led government and people of Cuba. And that pretty much then sent the relationships between the two countries into a deep freeze, lasting 50 years until this week. If the goal, economically speaking, was to change the government there, then the 50 years of deep freeze, the attack, the embargo, the refusal to have any diplomatic relations, has to be judged, economically speaking, a failure. If it was supposed to topple Castro, it was a failure. It did lead to the departure from Cuba of a large portion of its upper income and right-wing citizens. They moved to Florida and from there to other parts of the United States. That changed both what was the remaining population in Cuba, and it also affected politics in the United States, since these folks had a very particular take on the question of relations with Cuba and made their views well known. Did it cause suffering among the Cuban people over the last 50 years? Absolutely. But it also caused economic changes that are at least as important as the suffering, because whatever the suffering did, it did not bring down the regime. It did not bring down Mr. Castro. So whatever the suffering did, it did not have the desired political effects. But it did have economic effects that are important for us to think about. And I'm going to only mention some of them. One, it created a solidarity among the Cuban people that is extraordinary and is documented in many different ways. Even more important, it created a focus not on goods, but on services. Because they couldn't bring goods in, because they couldn't sell their goods very well around the world. They didn't get from Russia and other countries to whom they sold sugar the kinds of rewards they had gotten earlier by selling it in the United States, and so on. As a goods economy, they didn't do so well. So they refocused themselves, the way people always do, on what they could do, which were services. Since a number of the people who left Cuba were doctors, since they were in the upper income group and disproportionately on the right wing politically, they had immediately to face a medical emergency. And here they did something very interesting. They decided to solve their medical emergency by undertaking a massive training of Cuban people at all levels, doctors, nurses, medical technicians, and so on. And this emergency imposed refocusing of their economy turned out to give them an enormous boost. Cuba has become the source of teams of medical professionals, doctors, nurses, technicians, and so on, that Cuba has exported. That is, it has sent these teams around the world and used them to pay for imports that the Cubans needed. For example, thousands were sent to Venezuela to pay for the oil Cuba needed from Venezuela. And they were sent to many, many other countries. Cuba is the leading provider to this day of medical personnel to deal with the Ebola crisis in Western Africa. So it gave Cuba a whole new industry. Here's another one that you might find interesting. Cuba's tourism changed. It had been a source of tourism income, but from gambling, from criminal elements that had made Havana a kind of 90 miles from America place where prostitution, drugs, gambling, things you could not legally do in the United States were kind of wide open. With the embargo from the United States, all of that stopped, and Cuban tourism was reoriented to being a tourism for middle and income people from Europe who were organized to bring people for the beaches and for the wonderful climate that Cuba has. So it changed its whole tourism industry in a way that almost anybody who's reasonable would see as a plus. Finally, and just as important, the Cuban economy reoriented itself to a global economy. That is, Cuba stopped relying on one country overwhelmingly, the United States, which makes you very vulnerable. And it expanded and supported trade and developments of all kinds with many different countries, not just Russia, China, and the other parts of that world, but all over the world. Spain became very important, and so on, in Cuba's development. So it is less vulnerable to one particular trading partner. So these are advances for Cuba, and they have now, of course, the satisfaction, I suspect, of not having ever wanted the cutoff in relations with the United States, and now seeing that it is once again politically convenient to reestablish the relationships and to allow the free trade between the two that the United States cut off for those 50 years. Let me turn now to respond to some of your questions. I wish I had time for more of our updates, but here's one that we do have time for today. Question. Are there any places where there is union growth, where the story about labor unions in the United States isn't the sad story of decline, decline, decline for the last 50 years? And the answer is yes. There are some occasional stories, and I'm going to bring you now two, but just to show you that the stories there also are interesting. The first one comes from the city and the region of Pittsburgh. What's happening in Pittsburgh recently is interesting because it has to do with a surge of union organizing across many different enterprises. One of the things that has weakened the labor movement, undoubtedly over past years, has been the parochialism, you might say, the focus of unions on this industry or that industry, the difficulties they have of organizing workers across industries, of working together. I mean, they've managed it sometimes, but you don't see it the way, for example, the Chamber of Commerce brings together and mobilizes all the different businesses, big and small, manufacturers and services, and so on, in order to advance those things that are good for all employers, regardless of their different needs. You'd like to see something like that on the labor side, but you don't see it as well organized or as effective. So the Pittsburgh story I thought would interest you. In Pittsburgh right now, there are union organizing drives in the healthcare sector, particularly trying to organize the many different kinds of workers at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. There are organizing drives at the casinos to organize the casino workers. There are organizing drives of professors, particularly adjunct professors, and I'll come back to that. And there are, of course, the efforts to organize low-paid retail workers and fast food workers, because those are all over the United States, and they're happening with intensity in Pittsburgh as well. But what I find interesting is that these union drives are coordinated. They're working together. They're helping each other. When the professors go on strike, the fast food workers are on the picket line with them, and vice versa. In a visit to Pittsburgh, an area from which he comes, the current head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, made the following remark I thought was interesting, quote, "Adjunct professors, like fast food workers, these days need food stamps." His point being, we can all work together because this is an economic system that is crunching all of us. Okay, there's action. There's growth, there's success, but most important, there's coordination and solidarity. And with that, things are possible that are not possible without it. Now the final word about adjunct professors. The training of college people in this country is going through a rapid change. It has been changing drastically for 25 years, but the change is now at breakneck speed. Most of that change is very bad. It has to do with converting universities, which once were places reserved for learning, for study, into businesses. The people doing this think this is a good idea. They think the business model is what should govern every other part of life. A classic mistake made periodically in history until folks recognize the cost of thinking that all the different parts of life have to be organized in the same way. But as businesses govern universities, as they become more like businesses, they seek to cut costs. And one of the ways they cut costs that they figured out is by reducing the number of professors, people who are paid a living salary to think, to read, and to bring the fruits of their trained educational development to their students as a way of developing our society. We instead now use adjuncts, people who are not well paid, anything like what professors used to get. They are required to teach way more courses than the professors used to have to teach. Because, of course, if you make them teach more courses, you're getting more work out of them. The stupidity of this is mind-boggling. The more time they have to spend grading papers, the more time they have to spend running around handling too many students' needs, the less time they have to keep up in their field, to read how their field develops. In other words, to be on top of what it is they're supposed to be teaching. So the quality of education goes down. The hassling of these young people means that their education is interrupted because they don't have the time to get their advanced degrees because they're too busy teaching at too little pay to have any time to do anything. It is self-destructive of an educational system, and it exploits these young academics terribly. So it's very good to see that they're organizing in order to do something, not only about how badly they're paid and treated, but to do something to improve an educational system that is less and less effective because it's run like a business. The last shorty update we will have time for is also a question. I have received several questions about the Uber phenomena. Uber is a new business in this country and abroad that basically substitutes for taxis. It is a way in which a company figured out it can mobilize large numbers of people to use their own cars that they have to buy, they have to maintain, they have to insure. And all this company does is basically use computers to put those folks in their car where others who need a ride are looking for a ride. And so to charge for this activity and therefore to substitute for taxis. This is a phenomena that has made this company extremely valuable, Uber, U-B-E-R, now valued in the market at in the neighborhood of $40 billion. And the advertising of Uber uses the phrase the sharing economy. The idea being, oh, we're helping each other. Those of us who have a car are giving a ride to those of us who need one. Okay, now let's unpack this and let's do the hard economics. First, Uber is a threat to an existing industry that employs large numbers of people. A rational economy would try to work this out, not simply confront taxi drivers with a catastrophe of losing their business, their jobs, their well-being, suffering, therefore, not only them, but their children, their wives, their community. We don't do that. Instead, we basically say, if another company can come along and offer a ride at a better deal, well, that's good. They win, and the losses, too bad. Irrational in terms of the larger society. But let's look a little more closely. What this does is it encourages anybody who can figure out, for example, a cheaper way to move people around than the taxi. Well, but do we really want a cheaper way, or do we want a cheaper, better way? Because what Uber provides, and they're in great trouble around the world now, has been, for example, a cheaper way. But one of the ways it's cheaper is they've pushed the burden of maintaining the automobile, insuring the automobile, on the individual owner, rather than making that a responsibility of the taxi company. Which means we, as riders, are in a car which may or may not have been well maintained by that individual, which may or may not be appropriately insured. We'll find out if something goes wrong. But that's not the way we handled the mostly regulated taxi industry. So we may get a cheaper ride, but in the long run, uh-oh. And let me ask you whether you consider this to be a sharing arrangement. Uber is famous for the following. When there's a storm, when there's an emergency, when there are traffic jams, they will send you a car if you call Uber on your telephone app. But they will jack up the price when the people wanting a ride are more than the number of people they can get there in a reasonable amount of time. They think that's clever. Let's look at that. It means that whereas before everybody paid the same when they took a taxi ride, if you were lucky you got one, if there were not enough of them, you had to wait. But what Uber does is change that. It says you get the taxi if you agree to pay the higher rate. And you don't get the taxi if you can't afford it. It's a system that doesn't share at all. It rations and delivers services to those most able to pay. And that, too, will have economic effects. Before you believe that something changing in a capitalist economy is some kind of good result, take a look, a close look. You'll usually see it has some benefits, but it also has some costs. And it is very important to look at both of them before you make a decision about whether this is a positive or a negative for society as a whole. We've come to the end of this first half of our program. Please stay with us. We will come back shortly for the second half. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. And I look forward to seeing you in a few seconds when we shift to the second half of this program.
Every few thousand years come true man's greatest fears. All the living things Mother Nature brings to tears. When the bombs are bursting in the air,
welcome back, folks. This is the second half of Economic Update. And as I promised at the beginning, here's where we remind you of some basics about this program in the hope that the first half has made it interesting enough that you might want to pursue these. First of all, we maintain two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. I'll repeat those in a few moments. These websites are useful services to you. They are available 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. They contain an archive of every one of these radio programs for the last 4 years. You're welcome to listen to any and all of them, to view them, etc. Number two, lots of extra material expanding on the topics we cover in this program are available for you there too. They exist in written form as short articles, in audio form as interviews and lectures, and in video form. Whichever you prefer, they're all available, cataloged there for you in ways designed to make them easy for you to use. And two other things these websites do. First, they allow you to communicate to us. If there are questions you would like me to respond to, such as those I just did regarding Uber, the car service, and so on, then this is the way for you to let us know what you would like us to focus on, what questions to answer, what topics to go over. And please send us your criticisms if you don't like something you hear here. We read every one. We can't answer all of your questions. There are simply too many, although we are thrilled, and I mean that, to get them and to have them focus our attention in planning the programs. And finally, you can follow us by simply clicking on the icons for Facebook, Twitter, or Pinterest, all of which we are active on, and all of which allow you to follow us literally on a day-by-day basis. So I want to draw your attention again to these two websites that we maintain, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. And not to be immodest, these websites also give you a way to click on a donate button if you would be so inclined to help us pay for the costs of doing all of this. We really would appreciate financial support. Let me make clear, the support we request is separate from the support that we encourage you to give to the local radio stations that bring this program to you. We work closely with them. They deserve your support. I believe we also do. So we are both, in a sense, appealing to you, particularly at this time of year, for whatever support you can provide to us. And finally, I do want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I write for, among other people, and that is something I urge you to take a look at truthout.org. Okay, let's continue with another question before we turn to a major topic for this part of our program. The question has to do with the so-called disappearance of the middle class. I want to thank the many of you who send me questions about this, and it's interesting that it's a topic that doesn't go away. It shows us, if we didn't know it already, that many, many Americans are hurting. They know that the economy is not being good to them. They worry about it a lot. They suffer. They're hoping that these hard times will somehow pass. They grasp often at the straws that politicians drop, suggesting that that might be happening, will be happening, could be happening. So it's painful for me to have to tell you that we're not having a recovery, but there really is no other way that I could be honest. And if you don't want this, then obviously this is not the program for you. You can go back and listen to the conventional sources of economic news who will tell you what it is you're supposed to believe, but not so much what's actually going on. So here's a remarkable piece of information. Sums it up. That's why I want to present it to you. I'm taking this from a series, a very worthwhile series, in the Washington Post, one of the best newspapers in this country. They have a series by Jim Tankersley, which has quite an arresting title. Quote, Why America's Middle Class is Lost. Not my title, his title. Series started on December 12th of 2014. And here's one of the arresting statistics, but as I say, it's a series I would urge you to read. Median household income in America. Now, median means it's the 50% point. 50% of families and households in America do better than what I'm about to tell you, and 50% do less well. So this is the midpoint, you might say, the median household income. And the comparison Jim Tankersley makes in his article is how things were 15 years ago, and how they are as of 2013, the last full year for which he had statistics. And here's his arresting statistic. In 81% of the counties, every state in America is divided into counties. In 81%, more than 4 out of 5 counties across the entire United States, the median household income today is lower than what it was 15 years ago. In other words, even before capitalism broke down in 2007 and 8, and we had the kind of crisis we've been living through, even before that, the trend was downward. We haven't recovered. Not only have we not recovered to where we were in 2006 and 7 before the crisis proper hit, we haven't recovered even to the last 15 years going back. In other words, this new millennium, the 21st century, has been a downward experience for most Americans across this country. There is no wonder then that people feel that the middle class is lost, that the middle class is going nowhere. It's not just that we are in decline. It's also that we were supposed to be increasing. We were supposed to be doing better. Okay. Two major topics in the time that we have left. First, a decision this last week from the Supreme Court had to do with the case of Integrity Staffing Solutions versus Busk, B-U-S-K, Busk the individual. And the Supreme Court made a unanimous ruling that absolutely requires some commentary from us. Here was the issue. The Integrity Staffing Solutions is a temp agency. That's a place that you go to if you're needing a job, you haven't been able to find a regular full-time job with an employer. So you go to a temp agency, which places you temporarily in this place or that place. The pay for these kinds of jobs is usually poor. The benefits in these kinds of jobs, few to none. It's not a happy place for most working people to end up. And Integrity Staffing Solutions is the kind of company with the kind of euphemistic name that is less ugly than the temp agency reality proves to be. And here's what Integrity Staffing Solutions did. It made a deal with Amazon, among other employers, made a deal with Amazon for people to do temporary work, probably connected with the holidays, but in any case, temporary work. And here was a peculiar aspect of this job. When the job working in Amazon for whatever it is Amazon wanted temp workers to do, when the job was over, the Amazon company got the Integrity Staffing Solutions temp agency that they had contracted with to, here we go now, require the workers to stand in line for what was called a security screening. What this meant was, basically, that Amazon and Integrity Staffing Solutions were worried that workers might be stealing something from the Amazon warehouse and taking it home. And by having them stand in line and pass through a screening procedure, they could reduce or eliminate theft. At least, that's what they said. The problem was, then, that because they didn't have enough people or enough machines, the workers often ended up waiting online for an additional 25 minutes before they could leave the job at the end of the day and go home. So far, so good. But, and this is the biggest but of all, Mr. Busk, who is the plaintiff in this case, said that he felt, and there were many other workers who felt the same, that if they were going to be required to stand in line for 25 minutes, that would be time that they would have to be paid for. The companies that hired them were insisting as a condition of employment that they stand in this line for as long as it took. And the workers said, okay, we will do what you insist on, but you must pay for our time. No, said Integrity Staffing Solutions. No, said Amazon, although the issue is really with Integrity Staffing, since they're the immediate employer of these temp workers. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And what I found remarkable was that the Supreme Court decided unanimously, not just the right-wing half, but the left-of-center half too, that the workers did not require to get paid. That is, Integrity Staffing would not have to pay these workers. And they used a narrow interpretation of precedent of earlier cases because standing in line was not the work they were hired to do, which was running around the warehouse of Amazon doing its normal activity. So that was really not their job, standing in line. So they wouldn't have to get paid because they weren't doing the job. The fact that the company insisted, the fact that this was time demanded, imposed on the workers, didn't count. I have only really one comment about this, beyond wanting to make sure you all thought about what it means, is the following. Our Supreme Court, or at least the liberal part of it, has shown itself to be quite sensitive to issues of ethnic difference, gender difference, racial difference. But here's an issue that's a straight out class matter. This has to do with the relationship between employer and employee. I think almost any worker, whatever his or her politics, would respond on a gut level to the following. If an employer insists that the only way you can keep your job is by spending time that you lose from your life to do something that's advantageous to the employer and does nothing for you, the vast majority of workers don't steal anything and are proven not to by the screening. We all know that. That's on the record. So this is good for the employer, maybe, bad for the worker, and insisted on by the employer. The notion that the employer has no obligation to pay for something demanded is extraordinary. That the employer is not told, if you want to take time away from your worker doing the jobs you want to subject him or her to a screening, do that in the period of the time, 8 hours or whatever it is, that you pay the person. In many areas, time, in the end, is what you're paying for when you hire a worker. You tell him or her what to do, it's his or her time that you pay for. So I think this is a sign of a wholesale failure, in the United States at least, to appreciate and to respect labor, labor time, and labor pay. And at a time when Amazon is reckoned one of the most valuable and profitable companies in the world, and temp workers are among the people endlessly shown statistically to be having a hard time, to now say this is the right moment in which to say Amazon, through the temp agency, doesn't have to pay for the time it requires of these low-paid workers, tells you something, and it's something we should take to heart. The other major topic for today has to do with the United States labor force, and more particularly with the fact that both men and women in the prime working ages, which are 25 to 54, that's how we organize statistics in the United States, that's considered the prime working age. Men and women in that prime age, working age, are dropping out of the labor force. We are falling behind most other advanced industrial countries in the proportion of people that are working. It is crystal clear that this is having a whole host of negative effects on our larger economy. I'm going to mention them in a minute. So it's very interesting because of that. And in the case of these workers, clearly they're deciding not to work and instead to do something else. The question is that because the something else is much more attractive and satisfying to them? And that's why they're making this decision? Or might it be better to say that they are dropping out because the work experience is deteriorating? If that were the case, then workers are leaving a deteriorating work situation for a second best alternative at the same time that doing so damages the larger economy. If that were the case, and I am going to argue with you in the next few minutes that that's exactly what's going on, then this is called a lose-lose situation. Bad for the individual worker and his or her family, and bad for the larger economy. So what are the bad, larger social economic costs of people dropping out of the labor market? Well, the first is the income of families goes down if workers, adults, people from 25 to 54 stop working. That affects the family income, that affects the children, and other things equal, with less income, the ability of the family to support its members, to educate its members, is damaged. So there will be social damage to the family from not working and the income that is suffered. Number two, when you don't work, you lose the skills that working involves, and those lost are not easily regained. Number three, when there are fewer workers earning, that's lowered contributions by them into the Social Security and Medicare systems. That makes the finances of those systems dicier, makes it a problem, builds the support to cut benefits. It's a difficulty imposed on the society as a whole by the reduction in the number of workers. And finally, no small number of people leaving regular jobs find work instead in the unrecorded, and that usually means illegal, parts of our economy. In the huge drug trade, the armaments, illegal guns business, and so on under the table. And it's not clear, because of the taxes that are lost, it is not clear at all that there's any benefit from this. In fact, there are large costs. So those are the social costs. But let's look into why the individuals, to see what we want to conclude there. And there I thought I'd present to you a quotation from Professor Alan Krueger, very famous economist who's a professor at Princeton. And he was asked point blank, why is it that the men, because we're going to deal with men and women differently here, why is it that the men aged 25 to 54 are leaving the workforce? His answer, based on major research that he is famous for, is this. Men are leaving the workforce, says Professor Krueger, because they're not paid enough or there is no job suitable for the skills and experience they have. So it's crystal clear to Professor Krueger that the men leaving work are leaving because the conditions of their jobs, the pay and so forth, simply is inadequate, is not what they were used to, is not what they were trained for, is not what they are expected, ever expected. So they're going into other things, school, disability pay, living on their savings, illegal activity, not because they want to, but because where they were is no longer a sufficient reward, so they're looking elsewhere. It's different with women. And I want to end today's analysis of this withdrawal of both men and women from the labor force by focusing a little bit on the women. The comparisons here are dramatic. Percent of women in the prime age, 25 to 54, that work in Sweden, 83%. In the United States, 69%. That's an enormous difference. What's going on? Why do women, and this, by the way, France, Germany, all of them are much higher in the percentage of the women in their society who have regular jobs than in the United States. And it didn't used to be that way. 25 years ago, it was the other way around. So the United States has really deteriorated. The United States is a society unlike other advanced societies, where the proportion of women in the workforce has gone up. In this country, it has gone down. And the results of research give us the answer. The most famous research done by Professor Claudia Goldin at Harvard. And she had a paper earlier this year printed in the American Economic Review, the major journal in the economics profession in this country. But her research is cited in many other articles, in many newspapers. So here is the gist of her explanation. In all other advanced countries, there are many more supports to enable women to go out to work than there are in the United States. That's it. That's the answer. Let me give you an example. There are financed daycare centers for children. There are direct subsidies to families to help care for children. There are paid maternity leaves, paid paternity leaves. There are social welfare supports where welfare workers help you in your home if you wish. Across the board, the answer given everywhere is that women in other capitalist advanced societies get supports from their governments through the tax system and through social spending that they don't get in the United States. They can afford to go to work. They can make the choice without sacrificing their children and without sacrificing their families, and they make that choice once they are free to do so in those conditions. American women explain that they can't afford it. They cannot pay the private costs of it. And the bottom line, therefore, is we simply have to choose, and we choose not to work. It's not what we would want, just like with the men. It's not what we would want. It's our second best. So this society's kind of capitalism that refuses to fund these things pays in the damage to the individual men and women and the damage to the larger economy that comes from it. We've come to the end of this program of Economic Update. I hope you found these analyses interesting. If you do, please again, visit our websites, rdwolf with two f's.com and democracyatwork.info for ways to communicate with us, to donate, and to support. Thank you again, and I look forward to talking with you and meeting with you again next week.